Disc 10.
Jesus God, Dr. Lanier says. How weird is that? And she didn't hear anything, see anything? It's the middle of the day. She was out on the street like the rest of us.
The house is that of a neat person with a reasonably good income and expensive tastes, Scarpetta notes. Oriental rugs are machine-made but handsome, and to the left of the front door is a cherry entertainment center with an elaborate sound system and large-screen television. Bright Cajun paintings hanging on the walls are joyous in their loud primary colors and primitive depictions of fish, people, water, and trees. Rebecca Milton, if she is the victim, loved art and life. In whimsical frames are photographs of a tan woman with shiny black hair, a bright smile, and a slim body. In several other photographs, she is in a boat or standing on a pier with another woman, also with dark hair, who looks enough like her to be her sister.
"We're sure she lived alone?" Scarpetta asks.
"It appears she was alone when she got attacked," Clark says, scanning pages in his notepad.
"But we don't know that for a fact."
He shrugs. "No, ma'am. We don't know much of anything for a fact at the moment."
"I'm just wondering, because many of these pictures are of two women who seem to have a close relationship. And a number of the photographs were taken inside this house or on what appears to be the front porch, or perhaps in the backyard." She points out the hair swipes near the baseboard and interprets them. "Right here she went down, or someone did, and whoever it was, the person was bleeding sufficiently for her hair to be bloody."
"Yeah, well, she's got a big-time head injury. I mean, her face is smashed up bad," Clark offers.
Straight ahead is the dining room, with a centered antique walnut table and six matching chairs. The hutch is old, and behind its glass doors are dishes with gold around the rims. Beyond, through an open doorway, is the kitchen, and it does not appear that the killer or the victim moved in this direction, but off to the right of the living room, the pursuit continuing through a blue-carpeted hallway and ending in a bedroom that faces the front yard. Blood is everywhere. It has dried a dark red, but some areas of the carpet are so soaked that the blood is still damp. Scarpetta pauses at the end of the hallway and examines blood droplets on the paneled wall. One drop is round, very light red inside, and very dark around the rim. Surrounding it is a spray of other droplets, some almost too small to see.
"Do we know if she was stabbed?"
Scarpetta turns around and asks Clark, who is hanging back at the beginning of the hallway, busy with a video camera. Dr. Lanier has already walked inside the bedroom. He appears in the doorway and looks grimly at her.
"She's been stabbed, all right," he replies in a hard voice. "About 30 or 40 times."
"Along the wall here are sneeze or cough patterns of blood," Dr. Scarpetta tells him. "You can tell because the dark-rimmed drops here, here, and here," she points them out, "indicate bubbles. Sometimes you see that when a person's bled into the airway or lungs, or she may just have had blood in her mouth."
Scarpetta walks to the left edge of the bedroom door, where there is only a small amount of blood. Her eyes follow finger smears of whoever grabbed the doorframe, and more drips on the carpet that continue through the doorway onto the hardwood floor. Her view of the body is blocked by Dr. Lanier, Eric, and Nick Robillard. Scarpetta walks in and shuts the door behind her without touching any bloody surface, including the knob. Nick sits on the back of her heels, a 35mm camera gripped in her gloved hands, her forearms resting on her knees. If she's happy to see Scarpetta, she makes no sign of it. Sweat rolls down her neck, disappearing into the dark green Zachary Police Department polo shirt tucked in khaki cargo pants. Nick gets up and moves to one side so Scarpetta can approach the dead body.
"She's got really weird stab wounds," Nick comments. "The temperature of the room when I got here was 70 degrees.
Dr. Lanier inserts a long chemical thermometer under the body's arm. He leans close to the body, his eyes moving up and down it, taking his time. Scarpetta vaguely recognizes the woman as one she saw in some of the photographs scattered throughout the living room. It isn't easy to tell. Her hair is matted with dried blood, her face swollen and deformed by contusions, cuts, and smashed bones, the degree of tissue reaction to injuries consistent with her having survived for a while. Scarpetta touches an arm. The body is warm, as in life. Rigor mortis hasn't begun, nor has livor mortis, or the settling of the blood due to gravity once circulation stops. Dr. Lanier removes the thermometer, reads it, and says,
"Body temps, 96.
She's not been dead long at all, Scarpetta says. Yet the condition of the blood in the living room, hallway, and even some in here suggests the attack occurred hours ago.
Probably the head injury is what got her, but it took a little while, Dr. Lanier says, gently palpating the back of the head. Fractures. You get the back of your head smashed against a masonry plaster wall, and you're talking serious injuries.
Scarpetta isn't ready to comment on the cause of death, but she does agree that the victim suffered severe blunt force trauma to her head. If the stab wounds cut or completely severed a major artery, such as the carotid, death would have occurred in minutes. This is unlikely, impossible, really, since it appears the woman survived for a while. Scarpetta sees no arterial spatter pattern. The woman may still have been barely alive when her boyfriend found her at 12:30 p.m., and was dead by the time the rescue squad arrived. It is several minutes past 1:30 now. The victim is dressed in pale blue satin pajamas, the bottoms intact, the top ripped open. Her belly, breasts, chest, and neck are clustered with stab wounds that measure 16 millimeters, or approximately 3/4 of an inch, with both ends blunt, one end slightly narrower than the other. Those injuries that are superficial indicate she wasn't stabbed with an ordinary knife. Almost in the center of those shallow wounds is an area of tissue bridging that indicates the weapon had some type of gap at the tip, or perhaps was a tool that had two stabbing surfaces, each of them a slightly different thickness and length.
"Now that's strange as hell," Dr. Lanier says,
his head bent close to the body as he moves a magnifying lens over wounds.
"Not any normal knife I've ever seen. How about you?"
He looks at Scarpetta. "No." The wounds were made at various angles, some of them V or Y-shaped due to twisting of the blade, which is common in stab injuries. Some wounds gape, others are buttonhole-like slits, depending on whether the incisions are in line with the elastic fibers of the skin or cut across them. Scarpetta's gloved fingers gently separate the margins of a wound. Again, she puzzles over the area of uncut skin stretching almost across the middle. She looks closely through a lens, trying to imagine what sort of weapon was used. Gently gathering the pajama top together, she lines up holes in the satin with wounds, trying to get some idea where the clothing was when the woman was stabbed. 3 buttons are missing from the torn pajama top. Scarpetta spots them on the floor. 2 buttons dangle by threads. When she arranges the pajama top neatly over the chest, the way it would be were the victim standing, of course the holes don't line up with the stab wounds at all, and there are more holes in the satin than there are wounds. She counts 38 holes and 22 wounds. Overkill, to say the least. Overkill that is typical in lust murders, but also typical when the assailant and victim know each other.
"Anything?" Dr. Lanier asks her.
Scarpetta is still lining up holes and is getting somewhere. It appears that her top was bunched up above her breasts when she was stabbed. See? She moves up the top, which is so stained with blood very little of the satin looks blue. Some of the holes go through 3 layers of fabric. That's why there are more holes than wounds.
So he shoved up her top before he stabbed her, or while he was stabbing her, and then tore it open?
I'm not sure, Dr. Scarpetta replies. It is always so difficult to reconstruct, and a much more precise job will require uninterrupted hours under a good light in the morgue. Let's turn her just a bit and check her back. She and Dr. Lanier reach across the body and hold it by the left arm. They pull her over, but not all the way, and blood runs out of wounds. There are at least 6 stab wounds on her upper back, and a long cut to the side of her neck.
So she's running and he's stabbing. She's in front of him at least at some point.
It is Eric who deduces this as he and Nick return with several lamps and plug them in. Maybe, is all Scarpetta has to say about it. One smear on a wall in the hallway looks like she may have been pushed up or knocked up against it, about midway in the hallway. Maybe he shoved her against it and stabbed her in the back, and then she got away and ran in here, Nick proposes.
Maybe, Scarpetta says again, and she and Dr. Lanier gently lower the body to the floor.
This much I can tell you. Her pajama top was in disarray when some of these stab wounds to her chest and belly were inflicted.
The pushed-up top suggests a sexual motive, Eric says.
This is a sexual murder with tremendous rage, Scarpetta replies, even if she wasn't raped.
She might not have been.
Dr. Lanier bends close to the body, collecting trace evidence with forceps.
Fibers, he comments. Could be from the pajamas. Despite what people think, rape isn't always involved. Some of these bastards can't do it, can't get it up. Or they'd rather masturbate.
Scarpetta asks Nick, she was your neighbor. You're sure this is Rebecca and not the other woman in the photographs? The two women are very similar in appearance.
It's Rebecca. The other woman is her sister.
Lives with her? Dr. Lanier asks.
No, Rebecca lived alone.
For now, that will be a pending identification until we can be sure with dental records or some other means,
Dr. Lanier remarks as Eric takes photographs, using a 6-inch plastic ruler as a scale, arranging it next to whatever he shoots.
I'll get on it.
Nick stares without blinking at the dead woman's battered, bloody face, the eyes dully staring out from swollen lids.
We weren't friends at all, never socialized, but I saw her on the street, doing yard work, walking her dog.
What dog? Scarpetta looks sharply at her.
She has a yellow lab, a puppy, maybe 8 months old. I'm not sure, but he's not fully grown and was a Christmas present, I think from her boyfriend.
Tell Detective Clark to make sure the police go out and look for her dog, Dr. Lanier says. And while you're at it, tell them to make sure they send everybody they've got to keep this place secure. We're going to be here a while.
Dr. Lanier hands Scarpetta a packet of cotton-tipped swabs, a small bottle of sterile water and a sterile tube. She unscrews the caps of both the bottle and the tube. Dipping a swab in the sterile water, she swabs the breasts for saliva, the cotton tips turning red with blood. Swabs of her vagina, rectum, of every orifice can wait until the body's at the morgue. She begins to collect trace evidence.
I'm going outside, Nick says.
Someone needs to set up more lights in here.
Dr. Lanier's voice rises.
Best I can do is bring in lamps, whatever else is around the house, Eric replies. That would help. Photograph them in situ before you move them, Eric, or some goddamn defense attorney will say the killer carried lamps into the bedroom.
A lot of hairs, dog hairs maybe from her dog, Scarpetta is saying as she gently shakes forceps inside a transparent plastic evidence bag.
What?
A yellow lab?
Nick is gone.
That's what she said, a yellow lab puppy.
Dr. Lanier replies, the two of them alone with the body. The dog has to be found for a number of reasons, not the least is out of decency to make sure the poor thing is all right, Scarpetta says.
But for hair comparison, I can't be sure, but now I think I'm seeing quite a variety of animal hairs.
So am I, sticking to blood mostly here.
He points a blood-stained gloved finger at the woman's naked upper body.
Not on her hands or in her hair, though, which is where you might expect to find animal hairs if the origin of them is the floor, the carpet, here inside her residence.
Scarpetta is silent. She secures another hair in the forceps and shakes it loose inside a bag that must have at least 20 hairs in it now, the origin of all of them, the dried blood on the belly. Out on the street, someone has started whistling loudly. Voices are calling,
"Here, Basil! Come, Basil!"
The front door opens and shuts repeatedly, the sounds of feet moving in the living room, the dining room, cops talking, and then a woman's voice, a woman crying and screaming.
"No, no, no! That can't be!"
"Ma'am, just show us in one of these pictures."
Scarpetta recognizes Detective Clark's voice. He is loud and trying not to sound upset, but the more the woman screams, the louder he gets.
"I'm sorry, but you can't go in there."
"She's my sister!"
"I'm really sorry."
"Oh, God! Oh, God!"
Then the voices are quiet, and conversation recedes into a background murmur. A few flies begin to stray into the house, drawn by the scent of death, the high-pitched droning straining Scarpetta's nerves.
"Tell them to stop opening the goddamn door."
She looks up from her kneeling position, sweat rolling down her face, her knees in terrible pain.
"Jesus, what's going on out there?"
Dr. Lanier is angry, too.
"Here, Basil. Come on, boy."
Whistling.
"Yo, Basil, where are you?"
The front door opens and shuts again.
"That's it."
Dr. Lanier gets to his feet. He walks out of the bedroom, yanking off his bloody gloves. Scarpetta removes another animal hair, this one black, and places it inside an evidence bag. The hairs adhere to the body when the blood was wet. They are adhering to the belly, breasts, and chest, but not to the bottoms of the woman's bare feet, which are also smeared with dried blood, not from injuries, but from where she stepped. Scarpetta's breath is hot and loud behind her surgical mask, sweat stinging her eyes as she waves off flies and goes over the woman's face with a lens, looking for more hairs, every crack in dried blood magnified and more horrible, every split and cut in the skin more ragged and gaping. Flecks of paint adhere to blood, possibly transferred from the living room wall. The variety of animal hairs recovered from the body supplies Scarpetta with an important piece of information.
"We found the dog."
Nick is standing in the doorway. Scarpetta is startled back to a different dimension, one that isn't a hideous dry red landscape behind a magnifying glass.
"Basil, her dog."
That's not where most of these hairs are from. I'm finding dozens, different kinds, different colors. Dog hairs, possibly, much coarser than cat hairs, but I'm not positive. Dr. Lanier walks back inside the room, brushing past Nick, snapping on fresh gloves. What I'm seeing here makes me think the hairs were transferred from the perpetrator, perhaps from his clothing, directly to her upper body. Maybe if he got on top of her. She pulls the pajama bottoms down an inch, just far enough to expose the indentations left by their elastic waistband. She sits back on her heels and stares, then takes off her mask.
"Why would someone get on top of her and not take her pajama bottoms off?" Dr. Lanier puzzles. "Why would someone transfer all these dog or dog-like hairs to her naked upper body and nowhere else? And why the hell would anybody have all these dog hairs all the hell over them to begin with?"
"We found Basil,"
Nick says again,
"hiding under a house across the street, just cowering and shaking. He must have run off when the killer left, I guess."
"Who's going to take care of her? Of Basil?"
"I expect the boyfriend will," Dr. Lanier replies. "If not, Eric loves dogs."
He tears open two packets containing sterile, plasticized homicide sheets. While Scarpetta spreads one on the floor, Dr. Lanier and Eric grip the body under the arms and behind the knees, lifting it, centering it on the sheet. They spread the second sheet on top of her, rolling up the edges, wrapping her like a mummy, so no trace evidence will be added or lost. 116. Jay lifts a hand off the steering wheel to strike Bev, then changes his mind.
"You're stupid. You know that?"
he says coldly.
"What the hell did you think you were doing?"
"It didn't happen the way it was supposed to."
The radio inside his Cherokee continues with the 6 o'clock news as he drives toward Jack's boat landing.
"Dr. Sam Lanier, coroner of East Baton Rouge Parish, has not completed the autopsy yet, but sources close to the investigation have confirmed that the victim is 36-year-old Rebecca Milton of Zachary. The cause of death isn't official, but sources say she was stabbed to death. Police do not believe the murder is related to the women reported missing from Baton Rouge over the past year."
Fools.
Jay turns off the radio. Just lucky for you if they aren't assuming that. Four small dogs, mixed breeds, sleep in sunlight shining through a back window of the SUV. Five cases of beer are stacked on the back seat. Bev worked hard today after dropping Jay off at the University Lake in the heart of LSU. He didn't say why he was going there or what he'd be doing all day, only to pick him up in the same spot where she dropped him off at 5:30. Maybe he was looking for his escaped convict brother. Maybe he was wandering around, enjoying being away from Bev and the fishing shack. He was probably trolling for pretty coeds. Bev imagines him having sex with one of them. Jealousy wakes up inside her. It smolders.
"You shouldn't have left me all day," she says to him.
"What were you thinking? You were going to abduct her in the middle of the day and take her back to the boat in broad daylight?"
"At first. Then I knew you wouldn't be happy."
He says nothing, his face hard as he drives, careful not to speed or commit any other traffic infraction that could get him pulled over.
"She didn't look like her. She had black hair. I don't know if she went to college."
Bev had been unable to resist the impulse. She had time on her hands, time enough to find that pretty lady she had fixed on at the Walmart. Following her all night, she had learned that the Lamb didn't live in the house in the Garden District, but had a small place in Zachary. Her neighborhood was dark, and Bev started getting nervous that her Lamb might get suspicious. Bev had turned off on a side street before getting a good fix on the address. This morning she cruised, looking for the green Ford Explorer, figuring just because it wasn't parked in the driveway didn't mean it wasn't in the garage. Obviously she picked the wrong house. Once she was inside, she was committed. What she never anticipated was that this particular Lamb was going to fight like a wolf. The instant the black-haired woman answered the door, Bev reached inside her canvas bag and pulled out the gun, and was shoved so hard it flew out of her hand. Bev rolled on the floor and slipped a buck tool out of the sheath on her belt. She managed to open what she thought was a blade, and the chase began. It seemed to go on and on for miles, with the woman running and yelling and falling against a wall, which gave Bev the opportunity to grab her by the hair and slam her head against plaster, then kick her when she slid to the floor. Damn if she didn't get back up and punch Bev in the shoulder hard. It seems Bev was yelling too, but she can't remember. There was a roaring in her head like a freight train, and she stabbed and chased, blood flying in her face on and on forever. It couldn't have lasted more than a minute or two. Bev pinned the woman to the bedroom floor and stabbed and stabbed, and now she isn't sure if any of it really happened. Until she keeps hearing it on the radio. Until she remembers the buck knife's bloody bottle opener. She stabbed the woman with a bottle opener. How could that have happened? She looks at Jay, passing by pawn shops and car dealers, and a Taco Bell that makes her want to stop. Nachos with sour cream, cheese, chili, and jalapenos. Pizza places, auto shops, and car dealers, and then the road narrows and is lined with mailboxes as they move along back to Jack's, then the bayou.
"Maybe we could stop and get us some peanut brittle," Bev says. "It's early, too early. I don't understand why you don't want to wait till dark."
Jay won't speak to her.
"Well, have it your way, you and your fucking Baton Rouge, going back there because of your mangy brother." "Well, wait till dark when it's easier. Shut up. What if he's not there?"
A stony silence.
"Well, if he is, he's probably in that damn creepy cellar, hiding, maybe getting the money stashed down there. We could use some more money, baby. All that beer I've been buying. I told you to shut up."
The colder he gets, the prouder she is of the red bruises and deep scratches on her arms, legs, chest, and other parts of her body where she must have been injured during what she refers to as a tussle. "They'll swab under her fingernails," Jay finally speaks to her. "They'll get your DNA.
"They don't have my DNA in any of their fancy databases," Bev replies. "No one ever took my DNA before you and me got the hell out of Dodge. I was just a nice lady running a campsite near Williamsburg, remember that?"
"Nice, my ass." Bev smiles. Her injuries are badges of courage and power. She didn't know she had it in her to fight like that. Why, one of these days, she might just go after Jay. Her bravado deflates. She could never overcome Jay. He could kill her with one punch to her temple. He's told her that.
One punch and he'd fracture her skull, because women don't have very thick skulls. Even stupid ones like Bev, he says.
"What did you do to her? You know what I mean," he says. "Your blood's soaked down the front of your clothes. You get on top of her like a man?"
"No, it's none of his business."
"Then how did your clothes get bloody from the neck to your crotch, huh? You climb on top of some girl who's bleeding to death and jerk off?"
"It doesn't matter. They don't think it's related to the other ones," Bev says.
"What word did she say?"
"What do you mean, what word?"
Bev's beginning to think he's getting loony. "When she was begging. She must have begged for you to stop. What word did she say to describe it?"
"Describe what?"
"What it felt like to be so fucking afraid of pain and death. What word did she say?"
"I don't know."
Bev tries hard to remember.
"It seems like she said, why?"
117. The room was cool, and there were no odors. Nick has read that line at least 5 times. Her mother might have been murdered just minutes before her husband, Nick's father, got home. Nick wonders if the killer heard her father's car and fled, or if it was just fate that the son of a bitch left when he did. It is 10 p.m. Nick, Rudy, Scarpetta, Marino, and Lucy sit inside Dr. Lanier's guest house drinking community coffee, the local favorite. Multiple abrasions and lacerations to the face. Scarpetta reviews the autopsy report. She said right off that she did not intend to gloss over any detail in order to spare Nick's feelings. She would not be helping Nick if she did that. Abrasion and laceration of the forehead, periocular ecchymosis, fracture of the nasal bones, frontal teeth are loosened.
"So he beat her face up pretty good," Marino says, sipping coffee,
which is just the way he likes it, white with cremora and heavily laced with sugar.
"Any possibility this was someone she knew?" he asks Nick.
"She opened the door for him. She was found right near the door."
"Was she careful about keeping the doors locked?" Lucy looks at her intensely, leaning into the conversation. Nick stares back at her.
"Yes and no. At night, we locked up. But she knew Papa and I would be coming home soon, so she may not have had the door locked."
"That doesn't mean the person didn't ring the bell or knock," Rudy points out. "It doesn't mean your mom was afraid of whoever it was."
"No, it doesn't mean that," Nick says.
Blunt force trauma to the back of the head. Stellate laceration of vertex 3 by 4 inches. Massive hematoma of vertex and back of the head. 50 milliliters of liquid subscalpular blood. Marino and Lucy trade scene photographs back and forth. So far, Nick has not looked at them.
"Blood on the wall just left of the door," Marino observes. "Hair swipes. How long was your mother's hair?"
Nick swallows hard.
"Shoulder length. She had blonde hair, pretty much like mine."
"Something happened the minute he walked in. Blitz attack," Lucy says. "Not so different from what happened to Rebecca Milton. Not so different from what happens in any blitz attack when a victim really enrages the perp."
"Would injuries like this be consistent with her head being slammed against the wall?" Rudy asks.
Nick is stoical. She reminds herself she is a cop. Scarpetta meets Nick's eyes.
"I know this is hard, Nick. We're trying to be honest. Maybe you won't have so many questions if we're honest."
"I'll always have questions, because we're never going to know who did this."
"Never say never,"
Marino replies.
"Right,"
Lucy nods.
Comminuted non-depressed fracture of the biparietal and occipital bones, fractures of the orbital roofs, bilateral subdural hematomas, 30 milliliters free blood over each. Okay, okay, okay.
Scarpetta turns a page. It is typed, not computer-printed. "She has stab wounds," she adds. Nick shuts her eyes.
"I hope she didn't feel any of this."
No one comments.
"I mean,"
she looks at Scarpetta.
"Was she feeling all this?"
"She was feeling terror.
Physically, it's hard to say what pain she felt."
"When injuries occur so quickly," Marino interrupts.
You know when you stick your hand in a drawer and cut yourself with a knife and don't feel it? I think it's like that, unless it's slow. Slow like in torture.
Nick's heart seems to flutter as if something is wrong with it.
She wasn't tortured, Scarpetta says, looking at Nick.
Definitely not.
What about the stabs? Nick asks.
Lacerations of fingers and palms. Defense injuries.
She glances at Nick again. Punctures of the right and left lung with 200 milliliters of hemothorax on each side. I'm so sorry. I know this is hard.
Would that have killed her? The lung injuries?
Eventually. But in combination with the head injuries, absolutely. She also had fractured fingernails on the right and left. Non-identifiable material recovered from under the nails.
Do you think it was saved? Lucy asks. DNA wasn't as advanced then as it is now.
I wonder what the hell non-identifiable is, Marino says.
What kind of knife? Nick asks.
Short-bladed. But just how short-bladed, I can't tell.
Maybe a pocket knife, Marino offers.
Maybe, Scarpetta says.
My mother didn't have a pocket knife. She didn't have any...
Nick starts to tear up, then regains control.
She wasn't into weapons, is what I'm saying.
He might have had one, Lucy tells her kindly. But my guess is if the weapon was a pocket knife, he didn't think he needed a weapon. Might have just been something he carried around with him like a lot of guys do.
Are the stab wounds different than the ones we saw today?
Nick asks Scarpetta.
Absolutely, she says.
118.
Nick begins to talk about her mother's antiques store. She says her mother owned it, but only worked there part-time to be available to her family. She says her mother was acquainted with Charlotte Dard. Nick stares at her mug of coffee.
If I fire this thing up one more time in the microwave, you think I'll have caffeine DTs tomorrow?
Your mother and Charlotte Dard were friends?
Marino asks.
Shit. You don't mind my asking, why the hell haven't you mentioned this before?
This is the God's truth, Nick replies. I never remembered it until just now. I guess I blocked out so much. I almost never think about my mother, or at least I didn't start to until these women began disappearing. Then today, that scene, what he did to Rebecca Milton, and now...
She gets up to reheat her coffee. The microwave runs loudly for a minute, the door opens, and she returns to the sofa, steam rising from coffee no longer fit to drink. It smells overcooked.
Nick, Scarpetta says, is your married name Robillard? She nods.
What is your family name?
Maya. My mother's name is Annie Maya. That's why hardly anybody realizes I'm her daughter. With time, people forget anyway. Cops who remember her death never associate me with her. I never say anything.
She sips her coffee, not seeming to mind the taste. Her antiques shop specialized in stained glass windows, doors, shutters, old salvage stuff, some of it really nice if you knew what you were looking for. And a lot of furniture was handmade out of Cyprus. Charlotte Dard was one of her customers, was remodeling her house and buying a lot of things from my mom's shop, and that's how the two of them got friendly. Not close.
She pauses, searching her memory.
My mom talked about this rich woman with a sports car and how beautiful her house was going to be when it was all done. I guess Mrs. Dard's business helped out a lot. Papa never made much as a schoolteacher.
Nick smiles sadly.
Mama did really well and was frugal. Most of what my father lives off now came from my mother, from how well she did with that shop.
Mrs. Dard was a drug abuser, Scarpetta says. She died from a drug overdose, an accident or a homicide. I'm suspicious of the latter. She supposedly was suffering blackouts not long before her death. Do you know anything about that?
Everybody around here does, Nick replies. It certainly was the talk of Baton Rouge.
She dropped dead in a motel room, the Paradise Acres Motel, sounds like the name of a cemetery, off Choctaw, a terrible part of town. Rumor was she was having an affair and met up with the person there. I don't know anything more than what was in the news.
What about her husband? Lucy asks.
Good question. I've never heard of anyone who's met him. How strange is that?
Except he's some sort of aristocrat and travels all the time.
Have you ever seen a picture of him? Rudy asks.
Nick shakes her head.
So he's not in the news?
He's really private, Nick replies.
What else? Marino asks.
Yeah, there's some kind of weird connection going on here, right?
Rudy looks at Scarpetta.
Some pharmacist came up as a suspect, and Rocco Caggiano was his lawyer.
Marino gets up for more coffee.
Think, Lucy encourages Nick.
Okay. She takes a deep breath.
Okay, here's something.
I think Charlotte Dard invited Mom to a cocktail party.
I remember. Mom never went to cocktail parties.
She didn't drink and was shy, felt out of place among uppity people. So this was a big deal that she was going. It was on the plantation, the Dard plantation. Mom went to drum up business for her shop, and out of respect for her best customer, Mrs. Dard.
When was this? Scarpetta asks.
Nick thinks.
Not long before my mother was killed.
How long is not long? Rudy asks.
I don't know.
Nick swallows hard again.
Days. Days, I think.
She wore this dress. Had to go out to buy it.
She shuts her eyes again. A sob catches in her throat. It was pink with white piping. It was still hanging on her closet door when she got killed, you know, hanging there to remind her it needed to go to the dry cleaners.
And your mother died less than 2 weeks before Charlotte Dard did, Scarpetta remarks.
Kind of interesting, Marino points out, that Mrs. Dard was so fucked up and having violent fits and nobody worried about her throwing a fancy garden party.
I'm thinking that, Rudy says.
You know what? Marino adds. I drove almost 20 hours to get here. Then Lucy made me airsick. I gotta go to bed. Otherwise I'll be making deductions that will cause you to arrest Santa Claus for something.
I didn't make you airsick, Lucy says. Go to bed. You need your beauty sleep. I thought you were Santa Claus.
He gets up from the couch and leaves, heading to the main house.
I'm not going to make it much longer either.
Scarpetta gets up from her chair.
Time to go, Nick says.
You don't have to. Scarpetta tries hard to help.
Can I ask you just one last thing? Nick says.
Of course. She is so tired her brain feels frozen.
Why would he beat her to death?
Why did someone beat Rebecca Milton to death?
Things didn't go the way he planned.
Would your mother have resisted him? Lucy asks.
She would have clawed his eyes out, Nick replies.
Maybe that's your answer. Please forgive me. I can't be much use to you now. I'm too tired. Scarpetta leaves the small living room and closes her bedroom door.
How are you?
Lucy moves to the couch and looks at Nick.
This is tough, really tough. Too tough to describe.
You're brave, Nick Robillard.
Worse for my father. He gave up on life. Quit everything.
Like what?
Rudy asks gently.
Well, he loved to teach. And he loves the water. Or used to. He and Mom, they had this little fishing camp where nobody would bother them. Out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, nowhere. He's never been there since.
Where?
Dutch Bayou.
Rudy and Lucy look at each other.
Who knew about it?
Lucy asks.
I guess whoever my mother chatted about it to. She was a talker, all right. Unlike my dad.
Where's Dutch Bayou? Lucy then asks.
Near Lake Maurepas, off Blind River.
Could you find it now?
Nick stares at her.
Why?
Just answer my question.
She lightly touches Nick's arm.
She nods, their eyes lock.
Okay, then. Lucy doesn't stop looking at her. Tomorrow. You ever been in a helicopter?
Rudy gets up.
I gotta go. I'm beat.
He knows. In his own way, he accepts it.
but he's not going to watch. Lucy gives him her eyes, aware that he understands, but in a way never will. See you in the morning, Rudy. He walks off, his feet light on the stairs. Don't be reckless, Lucy tells Nick. You strike me as the type who would and probably has been. I've been engaging in my own sting operations, she confesses. Dressing like potential victims. I look like a potential victim. Lucy examines her closely, looking her over, making an assessment, as if she hasn't been making assessments all night. Yes, with your blonde hair, body build, air of intelligence. But your demeanor isn't that of a victim. Your energy is strong. However, that could simply present more of a challenge to the killer. More exciting. A bigger coup. I've been wrongly motivated, Nick chastises herself. Not that I don't want him caught. More than anything, I want him caught. But I admit I'm more aggressive, more bullheaded, maybe putting myself in danger, yes, because of a task force that doesn't want small-town girls like me in their club. Even though I'm probably the only one who's been trained at the best forensic academy in the U.S., trained by the best, including your aunt. When you've been out there putting yourself in danger, did you observe anything? The Walmart where Catherine was abducted. I was there within hours of it happening. One thing still stands out. This lady who acted peculiar fell down in the parking lot, said her knee went out from under her. Something bothered me. I backed off and wouldn't help her up. Something told me not to touch her. I thought her eyes were weird, scary, and she called me a lamb. I've been called a lot of things, but never a lamb. I think she was some homeless schizo. Describe what she looked like. Lucy tries to remain calm, tries not to make the evidence fit the case instead of the other way around. Nick describes her. You know, the funny thing about it is, she looked a bit like this woman I saw a few minutes earlier inside the store. She was digging around in cheap lingerie, shoplifting. Now Lucy is getting excited. It's never occurred to anyone that the killer might be a woman, or at least have a woman who is an accomplice. Bev Kiffin, she says. Nick gets up for more coffee, her hand shaking. She blames it on caffeine. Who is Bev Kiffin? On the FBI's 10 most wanted list. Oh, my God. Nick sits back down, this time closer to Lucy. She wants to be close to her. She doesn't know why, but the near proximity of her is energizing and exciting. Promise me you won't go out there prowling again, Lucy tells her. Consider yourself on my task force, okay? We do things together. All of us. My aunt, Rudy, Marino. I promise. You don't want to tangle with Bev Kiffin, who is probably bringing the abducted women to her partner, Jay Talley, number one on the FBI's most wanted list. They hiding out here? Nick can't believe it. Two people like that are hiding out here? I can't think of a better place. You said your father has a fishing shack that he abandoned after your mother was murdered. Any possibility Charlotte Dard might have known about it? Known where it was or is?
Is. Papa never sold it. The place must be half rotted by now.
Mrs. Dard must have known since my mother was so into salvage, the stuff she sold in her shop. She liked old weathered wood. Would recommend using it for fireplace mantles, exposed beams, whatever. Especially she liked the thick pilings the fishing shacks are built on. I don't know what she might have said to Mrs. Dard, but my mother was completely trusting. She thought everybody had their good qualities. The truth is she talked too much. Can you show me where the fishing shack is, the one your father abandoned? It's in Dutch Bayou off the Blind River. I can show you. From the air? I'm pretty sure, Nick says. 119. Benton leaves his Jaguar tucked in a church's back parking lot less than half a mile from the Dard plantation house. Every time he hears a car or truck approaching from either direction, he crashes through underbrush and hides in thick woods across the road from the Mississippi River. In addition to not knowing who might come along, he is well aware that it would appear odd to see a man in a black suit, black T-shirt, black cap, and black butt pack walking along the side of a narrow road in the rain. Someone might stop and ask if he's had car trouble. People would stare. When he spots the gates that he drove past late last night, he leaves the pavement and enters the woods, this time penetrating deeper until the mansion rises above trees, his scan constant. Looking where he steps, he does his best to avoid snapping fallen branches. Fortunately, the dead leaves are wet and silent. When he scouted the area last night, he didn't venture into the woods because it was too dark to see, and he didn't dare use a flashlight. He did, however, climb over the gate, getting rust all over his jacket and jeans, one of many explanations for why he opted to wear his suit again. He wondered how much the place had changed since he had been here last. In the dark, it was difficult to tell whether it had been kept in good repair, but his last act was to toss a rock near shrubbery around the front to see if the motion sensors lit up. They didn't. He tried again, and not a single light was triggered. If any of them are still in working order and he activates them this morning, they won't be conspicuous, even though the sun is blanketed in gray. The grounds used to have an elaborate camera system, but there was no way Benton would have been foolish enough to test cameras to see if they would turn red and follow him as if they were alive. The cars in the driveway are a new white Mercedes 500 AMC and an older model white Volvo. The Mercedes was not here last night. He doesn't know who it belongs to and doesn't have time or means to run the Louisiana plate. The Volvo belongs to Eveline Guidon, or at least it did 6 years ago. Grateful for dark clothing, Benton freezes like a deer behind a thick, dripping tree when the front door of the mansion opens. He crouches low, completely out of view, about 50 feet to the left of the front steps. U.S. Attorney Weldon Wynn walks out, talking in his usual booming voice, more obese than when Benton last laid eyes on him. Expecting him to climb into his expensive car, Benton thinks fast. Weldon Wynn's being here isn't according to plan, but certainly is a bonus. It strongly hints that Jean-Baptiste Chandon has sought or will seek asylum at his family's Baton Rouge stronghold, a plantation of incredible corruption that has escaped suspicion for decades because the people associated with it are either completely loyal or dead. Benton, for example, is dead. He watches Baton Rouge's despicable U.S. attorney follow an old brick walkway to an old stone building with a dark Gothic door that leads down into the wine cellar, the centuries-old cave, almost half a mile of convoluted tunnels dug by slaves. Wynn unlocks the door, steps inside, and shuts it behind him. Benton moves swiftly in a crouch, soaking wet by now, ducking behind the cover of boxwoods, glancing repeatedly from the wine cellar to the house. His riskiest move is his next. He walks casually, upright, his back to the house. Should anyone look out the window, the man in black may very well appear to be a Chandon friend. The door is thick oak, and he barely makes out voices behind it. 120. Scarpetta can't release Albert Dard from her mind. She imagines the scars on his little body and is well aware that self-mutilation is an addiction, and if he continues hurting himself, it seems likely that he will be committed to psychiatric hospitals again and again until he becomes as mentally ill as those patients whose diagnoses justify their being institutionalized. Albert Dard doesn't need to be committed. He needs help. He needs for someone to at least attempt to find out why his anxiety increased so severely a year ago that he shut down, repressed his feelings and perhaps memories to such an extreme that he now needs self-inflicted pain to experience control, a brief release, and an affirmation of his own existence. Scarpetta recalls the boy's almost dissociated state on the plane while he played with trading cards, violent ones relating to an axe. She envisions his extreme distress at the thought of no one meeting him, of an abandonment that she doubts is anything new. With each passing moment, she becomes increasingly angry at those who are supposed to take care of him, and frightened for his safety. Digging inside her pocketbook as she drinks coffee in Dr. Lanier's guest house, she finds the telephone number she wrote down when Albert waited for an aunt who did not intend to pick him up, but orchestrated events so that Scarpetta would take care of him. It no longer matters what manipulations or conspiracies were on Mrs. Guidon's mind. Perhaps it was all a lure to get Scarpetta to that house to see what she knows about Charlotte Dard's death. Perhaps Mrs. Guidon is now satisfied that Scarpetta knows nothing more about the death than has ever been known. She dials the number and is startled when Albert answers the phone.
"It's the lady who sat next to you on the plane," she says.
"Hi," he greets her, surprised and very pleased.
"How come you're calling me?"
"My aunt said you wouldn't."
"Where is she?"
"I don't know. She went outside."
"Did she leave the house in her car?"
"No."
"I've been thinking about you, Albert," Scarpetta says. "I'm still in town, but I'm leaving soon, and wondered if I could come by for a visit."
"Now?"
The thought seems to make him happy.
"You'd come see just me?"
"Would that be all right?" He eagerly says it would. 121. Benton quietly, carefully opens the wine cellar door, his Sig Sauer drawn and cocked as he stands to one side of the narrow opening. The conversation just beyond stops, and a male voice says,
"You didn't shut it all the way."
Feet sound on steps, maybe 5 steps, and a hand, most likely Weldon Wynn's, pushes the door to shut it, and Benton pushes back hard, the door opening wide and knocking Wynn down the steps, where he lies shocked and groaning on the stone floor. Whoever he was talking to had seconds, no more, to flee down another set of steps. Benton can hear the person running fast, getting away, but there is nowhere for him, perhaps Jean-Baptiste, to go. The cave has an entrance and no exit.
"Get up," Benton says to Wynn. "Slowly."
"I'm hurt."
He looks up as Benton stands on the top step, shutting the door behind him, while he keeps the pistol pointed at Wynn's chest.
"I don't give a goddamn if you're hurt. Get up."
Benton takes off his baseball cap and tosses it on top of Wynn. Recognition is slow, then Wynn's face blanches and his lips part as he lies twisted on the floor, tangled in his own raincoat, staring in horror.
"It can't be you," he says in awe. "It can't be."
All the while this is going on, Benton listens for footsteps, for whoever escaped. He hears no one. The small windowless space has a cobweb-covered naked light bulb overhead and a small, very old cypress table, covered with dark rings left by the countless bottles of wine that were tasted in here. Walls are damp stone, and attached to the one on the left of Benton are 4 iron rings in eye bolts. They are very old, but most of the rust is worn off. Nearby on the floor are coils of yellow nylon rope and an electrical receptacle.
"Get up," Benton says again. "Who else is down there? Who were you just talking to?"
The injured Weldon Wynn moves with surprising agility as he suddenly rolls on the floor and pulls out a gun from under his coat. Benton shoots him twice, once in the chest, once in the head, before Wynn can even get his finger on the trigger. Gunshots are muffled by stone. 122. Marino's personal payload is enough to slow the helicopter by 5 knots. Lucy isn't concerned. In this weather, she wouldn't push her machine up to maximum speed. There is no point in rushing to run into an antenna, and antennas are all over the place, rising out of swirling fog that makes the hairline obstacles and their strobes almost impossible to see in the distance. Lucy flies at 500 feet, the conditions worse than they were when they took off in Baton Rouge 20 minutes ago.
"I don't like this."
Marino's nervous voice sounds in Lucy's headset.
"You're not the one flying. Relax. Enjoy the flight. Can I get you anything, sir?"
"How about a fucking parachute?"
Lucy smiles as both she and Rudy keep up their scan outside the cockpit.
"You mind if I let go of the controls for a minute?" she says to Rudy for Marino's benefit.
"You're shitting me!"
Marino yells. "Ouch!"
Lucy turns down the volume in her headset while Rudy takes the controls.
"It's your ship," she repeats the standard line, ensuring that the other pilot knows for a fact that he's supposed to be flying at that precise moment.
Turning a small knob on her emergency watch, she changes the upper display to chronograph mode. Nick has never been up in a helicopter, and she tells Marino to stop making matters worse.
"If we aren't safe with them," Nick says, "we aren't safe with anyone. Besides, you're more likely to get hit by a car than crash in this weather."
"That's a bunch of shit. There ain't no cars up here. And I'd appreciate it if you wouldn't use the crash word."
"Concentrate,"
Lucy tells everyone, and she's not smiling now as she glances at the GPS. Yesterday, when she and Marino flew here and found the northwesternmost edge of the lake, she entered the coordinates into the GPS. We're exactly on track. Descending to 300 feet and slowing to 80 knots, she catches a glimpse of Lake Maurepas between rolling fog. The water is almost below them, thank God. No fear of antennas over a lake or its creeks and bayous. She slows down more as Rudy leans forward, staring hard, trying to make out the shoreline. Nick? Lucy asks. You hearing me?
Yes, her voice comes back.
Recognize anything down there? Lucy slows to 60 knots. If she reduces her airspeed more than that, she'll go ahead and hover, but she prefers not to do so out of ground effect with such poor visibility.
Can you go back a little ways so we can find Blind River? She asks. Dutch Bayou branches off it right at the edge of the lake.
Which direction? Lucy slowly banks the helicopter around, not thrilled about returning to land at this altitude, grateful that yesterday she was fastidious about noting the locations of any obstacles. Nick pauses, then her voice returns.
Well, if you follow the river toward the lake, Dutch Bayou would be at about 3 o'clock, to your right, she tells Lucy.
Swooping back around and getting on track, Lucy flies over water again.
That's it, Nick says. That's the river. See how it bends to the left? Well, we could see it better if we were higher.
Forget it, Rudy says.
I think, yes, Nick is getting excited. There it is, that very narrow creek. See it on your right? Dutch Bayou. My father's fishing shack isn't even a mile up it on the left.
Nerves are suddenly on edge. Rudy pulls his pistol out of his shoulder holster. Lucy takes a deep breath, tense and more apprehensive than she lets on as she descends to 100 feet, directly over a narrow bayou thick with cypress trees that appear ominous in the fog. At this altitude especially, they can already hear us, Lucy says calmly, focusing, thinking, trying not to react to what is quickly becoming a very dangerous situation. Suddenly, a dilapidated gray shack materializes. Tied to a warped pier is a white boat that is completely incongruous with its surroundings. Lucy swoops around the shack.
You sure? You sure?
She can't help it. Her adrenaline is raising her voice.
Yes! I recognize the roof. Papa used blue metal. I can still see some of the blue. And the same porch and screen door?
Lucy drops to 50 feet in a hover and turns to the left, Rudy's window lined up with the boat.
Shoot it!
Lucy yells at him. Rudy slides open his window. He rapidly fires 17 rounds into the bottom of the boat as the front door of the shack flies open and Bev Kiffin runs out with a shotgun. Lucy pushes the cyclic forward to push up her airspeed.
Duck, but stay in your seats.
Rudy has already slapped a new magazine into his gun. Although the seats in back are directly over the fuel cell, this isn't Lucy's concern. Jet A is by no means as flammable as gasoline, and the most damaged shotgun pellets might do is cause leaks. On the floor, there is less of the aircraft's skin to penetrate. Rudy arms the floats. The shotgun is pump action with a magazine extender. Bev fires 7 rounds, one right after another. Pellets shatter windows, smacking the composite skin and hit the main rotor blade and engine cowling. If the burn can is penetrated, there's going to be a fire, and Lucy immediately cuts off the throttle and lowers the collective. Alarms go off in desperate warnings as she lowers the collective, presses the right pedal, and turns into the wind, where there is no place to set down but an area of tall sawgrass. Nitrogen explodes like another gunshot and floats on the skids, instantly inflate like rubber rafts. The helicopter lurches out of trim, and Lucy fights to stabilize it, realizing that at least one of the 6 floats has been penetrated by shotgun pellets. The landing is hard enough to set off the ELT, and the helicopter rocks in dense grass and dark, muddy water and lists hard to the right. Opening her door, Lucy looks down. 2 of the 3 floats were penetrated and didn't inflate. Rudy shuts off the battery and the generator, and everyone sits for a moment, stunned and listening to the abrupt silence outside as the helicopter lists to the right, sinking into the muck. Not more than 300 feet away, they can see the boat taking on water, its bow rising as it sinks.
At least she's not going anywhere, Rudy remarks as he and Lucy take off their headsets.
Lucy unscrews a large cap on her watch and pulls out the antenna, activating her ELT.
Come on, she says. We can't sit here.
I can, Marino replies.
Nick, Lucy turns around. You got any idea how deep the water is right here?
Not too deep, or there wouldn't be all this sawgrass. It's the mud that's the problem. We could sink up to our knees.
I'm not going anywhere, Marino says. What for? The boat's sunk, so she ain't going anywhere either. And I'm not getting snake bit or eaten by a fucking alligator.
Here's what we can do, Nick continues, as if Marino isn't in the back with her.
The sawgrass stretches all the way behind the shack, and I know the water's not that deep because we used to put on high boots and collect mussels.
I'm going, Lucy says, opening her door.
Inside the shack, dogs are barking loudly. The problem for Lucy is that the fat float on her skid is going to make it impossible for her to lower herself gently, 1 foot at a time. She tightens the shoelaces on her ankle-high boots and hands Rudy her Glock and extra magazines. Perched in the doorframe like a skydiver, she says, "Here I go." She lands in the water feet first and is pleasantly surprised to find she sinks in just above her boots. If she steps quickly, she doesn't sink as much. Stepping closer, her face splattered with dirty water, she reaches out to take her weapon and wedges it into the back of her pants. She temporarily jams the extra magazines into a pocket. Everybody takes turns holding on to guns and ammo as Rudy, then Nick, jump out, exiting from the same side of the helicopter as Lucy did. Marino sits like an angry lump in the back seat.
"You're gonna sit there until the chopper turns over on its side?"
Rudy raises his voice.
"Idiot! Get out!"
Marino slides across the seats and tosses Rudy his gun. He jumps, loses his balance, and falls, his head hitting a float. When he manages to get to his feet, he is covered with mud and swearing.
"Shh,"
Lucy says. "Voices carry on the water. You all right?" Marino wipes his hands on Rudy's shirt and angrily takes back his gun as both ELTs flash brightly on radar screens in airport towers and are picked up by any pilots who happen to be monitoring the emergency frequency. They slog along, tensely keeping an eye out for snakes, hearing them rustle through the tall grass. When the four of them are within 100 feet of the shack, pistols held high, barrels pointed up, the screen door whines open again, and Bev dashes out on the pier with the shotgun, shrieking, screaming at them, insane and suicidal with desperation and rage. Before she can even take aim, Rudy fires.
Crack, 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 crack.
She hits the old wood planking and rolls into the water next to the half-sunken boat. 123. Albert Dard opens the imposing door, the front of his long-sleeve shirt spotted with blood. "What happened?" Scarpetta exclaims as she steps inside. She gets down and gently raises his shirt. In a tic-tac-toe pattern on his stomach are shallow cuts. Scarpetta lets out a long breath as she lowers his shirt and stands up.
"When did you do this?"
She takes his hand.
"After she left and didn't come back. Then he left. The man on the plane. I don't like him." "Your aunt didn't come back?"
Scarpetta noted when she approached the house that a white Mercedes and Mrs. Guidon's old Volvo were parked in front.
"You have a place where I can do something about those cuts?"
He shakes his head.
"I don't want to do anything."
"Well, I do. I'm a doctor. Come on."
"You are?"
He seems dazzled, as if he's never imagined that women could be doctors. He leads her up the stairs to a bathroom that, like the kitchen, hasn't been renovated in many years. Inside is an old-fashioned white tub, a white sink, and a medicine cabinet, where she finds iodine but no band-aids.
"Let's get your shirt off."
She helps him pull it over his head.
"Can you be brave? I know you can. Cutting yourself hurts, doesn't it?"
She is dismayed by the multitude of scars covering his back and shoulders.
"I don't really feel it when I do it," he says, watching anxiously as she unscrews the cap from the iodine.
"I'm afraid you're going to feel this, Albert. A little sting." She lies the way all doctors do when some procedure is going to hurt like hell. She works quickly while he bites his lip. He waves his hands to cool the burning while he tries not to cry. "You are brave," she says, lowering the lid of the toilet and sitting on it. "You want to tell me why you started cutting yourself?"
"Someone said it began several years ago."
He hangs his head. "You can tell me." She takes both his hands. "We're friends, aren't we?" He slowly nods.
"These people came," he whispers. "I heard cars. My aunt went outside, so I did too, only I hid. And they pulled this lady out of a car, and she was trying to scream, but they had her tied up."
He points at his mouth, indicating a gag.
"Then they pushed her into the cellar."
"The wine cellar?"
"Yes."
Scarpetta recalls Mrs. Guidon's insistence that she tore the wine cellar. Fear raises the hairs on the back of her neck.
"She is here."
She doesn't know who else is here except Albert, and someone could drive up at any moment.
"One of the people with the tied-up lady was a monster."
Albert's voice rises almost to a squeal as his eyes widen in terror.
"Like I've seen on TV, in scary movies, with these sharp teeth and long hair. I was so afraid he saw me behind the bush."
"Jean-Baptiste Chandon."
"And then my doggie, Nestle. She never came home again."
He begins to cry. Scarpetta hears the front door open and shut, then footsteps downstairs. "Is there a phone up here?" Scarpetta whispers to Albert. He nods, terrified, wiping away tears. "Go lock yourself in that room, and call 911 immediately if you hear anything that frightens you." He stares at her, paralyzed. He touches the wounds on his stomach, then rubs them, causing them to bleed. "Go. Don't make any noise." He walks quickly, quietly down the hall and turns into a room. For several minutes she waits, listening to footsteps until they stop. The footsteps sound like those of a man, relatively heavy, but not the sharp sound of hard leather against wood. He starts walking again, and Scarpetta's heart hammers as he seems to head toward the stairs. She hears him on the first step and walks out of the bathroom, because she does not want him, and she is certain he is Jean-Baptiste Chandon, to find Albert. At the top of the stairs she freezes, gripping the railing with all her might, looking down the staircase at him, the sight of him draining the blood from her head. She shuts her eyes and opens them again, thinking he will go away. Slowly she takes one step at a time, holding on to the railing, staring. Midway she sits down, staring. Benton Wesley doesn't move as he too stares. His eyes glisten with tears that he quickly blinks away. "Who are you?" Scarpetta's voice sounds miles away. "You aren't him."
"I am."
She begins to cry.
"Please come down. Or would you like me to come up and get you?"
He doesn't want to touch her until she is ready, until he is ready too. She gets up and slowly walks down the stairs. When she reaches him, she backs away, far away.
"So you're part of this, you bastard. You goddamn bastard."
Her voice shakes so violently that she can barely speak.
"So I guess you better shoot me, because now I know. What you've been doing all this time, I thought you were dead. With them."
She looks at the stairs as if someone is standing there.
"You are one of them."
"I'm anything but," he says.
Digging into a pocket of his suit jacket, he takes out a folded piece of white paper. He smooths it open. It is a National Academy of Justice envelope, just like the photocopy Marino showed her, the photocopy of the envelope containing the letters Chandon wrote to Marino and her. Benton drops the envelope to the floor where she can see it.
"No," she says. "Please, let's talk."
"You told Lucy where Rocco was.
You knew what she'd do.
You're safe.
And you set me up to see him. I never wrote to him. It was you who wrote a letter supposedly from me, claiming I wanted to come see him and make a deal."
"Yes."
"Why? Why would you subject me to that? To make me stare at that man, that awful excuse for life?"
"You just called him a man. That's right. Jean-Baptiste Chandon is a man, not a monster, not a myth. I wanted you to confront him before he died. I wanted you to take back your power.
You had no right to control my life, to manipulate me that way.
Are you sorry you went?
For an instant, she is speechless. Then she says, You were wrong. He didn't die. I didn't anticipate his seeing you would give him cause to stay alive. I should have known. Psychopaths like him don't want to die. I suppose because he pled guilty in Texas, where he knew he would be death eligible, I was fooled into thinking he really did want. You were wrong, she accuses him again. You've had too damn much time to play God, and I don't know what you've turned into. I was wrong, yes. I miscalculated, yes. Became a machine, Kay. He said her name, and it shakes her to her soul. There is no one here to hurt you now, he then says. Now? Rocco is dead. Weldon Wynn is dead. Jay Talley is dead. Jay? Benton flinches. I'm sorry, if you still care. About Jay? Confusion spins. She feels dizzy, about to faint. Care about him? How could I? Do you know everything? More than everything, he replies. 124. Inside the kitchen, they sit at the same butcher block table where Scarpetta talked to Mrs. Guidon on a night Scarpetta scarcely remembers.
I got in too deep, Benton is saying.
They are sitting across from each other. It was here, in this place of theirs, where a lot of the major players come to do their dirty business at the port and the Mississippi. Rocco, Weldon Wynn, Talley, even Jean-Baptiste.
You've met him?
Many times, Benton says. Here in this house. He found me amusing and much nicer to him than the others were. In and out, you name it. Guidon was the matron of the manor, you might say. As bad as the rest of them.
Was?
Benton hesitates. I saw Wynne go into the wine cellar. I didn't know the others were in there, thought maybe Jean-Baptiste was, hiding. It was her and Talley. I had no choice.
You killed them.
I had no choice, Benton repeats. Scarpetta nods. 6 years ago, another agent was working with me. Minor, Riley Minor, supposedly from around here. He did something stupid, I'm not sure what, but they did their number on him. Benton nods in the direction of the wine cellar. The torture chamber, where they make everybody talk. There are old iron rings in the walls from the slave days, and Talley was fond of heat guns and other means of deriving information, quickly. When I saw them dragging Minor into the cellar, I knew the operation was over, and I got the hell away.
You didn't try to help him?
Impossible. She is silent. If I hadn't died, I would have, Kay. If I hadn't died, I could never have been around you, Lucy, Marino, ever, because they would have killed you, too.
You are a coward, she says, drained of emotion.
I understand you're hating me for all I made you suffer.
You could have told me so I wouldn't suffer.
He looks at her for a long moment, remembers her face. It hasn't changed much. None of her has.
What would you have done, Kay? Had I told you my death had to be faked, and I would never see you again, he asks.
She doesn't have the answer she thought she might. The truth is, she wouldn't have allowed him to vanish, and he knows it.
I would have taken my chances.
Grief closes her throat again.
For you, I would have.
Then you understand. And if it's any consolation, I've suffered. Not a day has gone by when I didn't think of you. She shuts her eyes and tries to steady her breathing. Then I couldn't take it anymore. Early on, I became so miserable, so goddamn angry, and I began to figure a way. Like chess.
A game?
Not a game. I was very serious. One by one to eliminate the major threats. Knowing that once I came out, I could never go back. Because if I failed, I would be recognized. Or simply killed during the process.
I have never believed in vigilantism.
I suppose you can talk to your friend Senator Lord about that. The Shandans heavily fund terrorism, Kay.
She gets up. Too much for one day. Too much.
She glances up, suddenly remembering Albert. Is that little mistreated boy really Charlotte Dard's son?
Yes.
Please don't tell me you're his father.
Jay Talley was. Albert doesn't know that. He's always been given this mysterious line about a very prominent but busy father he's never met. A kid's fantasy. He still believes he has this omnipotent father somewhere. Talley had a brief affair with Charlotte. One night while I was here, there was a garden party, and Charlotte invited an acquaintance, an antique dealer.
I know, Scarpetta says. At least that question will be answered.
Talley saw her, spoke to her, went to her house. She resisted him, which is something he won't tolerate. He murdered her, and because Charlotte had seen the two of them together, and because Talley was tired of Charlotte, bored with her, he saw to it that she died. Met her. Brought her pills.
The poor little boy.
Don't worry, Benton says.
Where are Lucy and Marino? Where are Rudy and Nick?
Now she remembers them. Picked up by a Coast Guard helicopter about half an hour ago, after raiding Bev Kiffin's and Jay Talley's hideout.
How do you know?
He gets up from the table. I have my sources.
Senator Lord enters Scarpetta's mind again.
The Coast Guard is now Homeland Security.
Yes,
Senator Lord would know.
Benton moves closer to her, looking into her eyes.
If you hate me forever, I'll understand. If you don't want to be with me, I don't blame... Well, you shouldn't. Jean-Baptiste is still out there. He will come after me, somehow.
She says nothing, waiting for the hallucination to pass.
Can I touch you? Benton asks.
It doesn't matter who else is out there. I've been through too much.
Can I touch you, Kay?
She lifts his hands and presses them against her face. This is Kate Redding. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Blowfly by Patricia Cornwell. To find out more about the complete Books on Tape catalog of unabridged audiobooks, call our customer service department at the number on this package, or visit us online at booksontape.com. Blowfly by Patricia Cornwell. Copyright 2003 by Cornwell Enterprises, Incorporated. Published by arrangement with G.P. Putnam's Sons, a member of Penguin Group USA, Incorporated. Production copyright 2003 Books on Tape, Incorporated.